Instagram, Istanbul.
Seyed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The city of Severodonetsk lies mostly in ruins. It was the scene of some of the fiercest fighting between the two armies. It now resembles a post-apocalyptic wasteland. At a military base, a pro-Russian fighter pulls down a Ukrainian sign. What's left of the city is now in Russian hands. On the outskirts of town, a grain silo. Russia and Ukraine blame each other for bombing it.
Now, that may well be one of the most tragic places that I've been to in this war, because millions of people around the world may well go hungry due to this conflict because of the huge amounts of grain that Ukraine exports in usual times around the world. For those people, it won't really matter whether it was Russia or Ukraine who committed this strike.
Humanity is bombing its own food supplies. Unsurprisingly, few people remain in the city. Those that do are keen to tell of what they saw.
The Ukrainians knew where people lived. They drove around looking for people's houses. And when they fled, they occupied their houses and started firing. We live in that house, and they were firing from there for 3 weeks.
It wasn't all done by Russia. It was done by Ukraine. There are witnesses who saw tanks driving up and firing at houses, just like that.
While NATO and Ukraine blame Russia for the devastation, the strange truth is that everyone I spoke to here is more critical of Ukraine.
Ukraine acted in a sly way. They would bring a howitzer here, fire, and then leave. Then Russia would strike, and they would say Russia is bombing civilians. They were occupying kindergartens and would fire from there.
They made them sit in the basement and took over their flats. They put mortars on the roofs and fired. We don't know what Russia did. We didn't see them until we returned.
While Russia and Ukraine continue to blame each other for the devastation wrought by this conflict, there remains little appetite for peace. The longer this war goes on, the more of Ukraine will be destroyed, and the greater the threat to world food supplies and the global economy. Johnny Miller, Severodonetsk.
EU Foreign Affairs ministers held their last scheduled meeting on Monday before taking a six-week summer break. Of course, proceedings were dominated by the war in Ukraine.
Ukraine needs more arms. We will provide them. The war will continue. We'll continue supporting. And that's why I have proposed the next tranche of the European Peace Facility, allocating 500 million more.
Josep Borrell has doubled down on criticism of sanctions against Russia and their impact on EU citizens. He has even written a blog on the subject. It's reported he's doing this because of growing disquiet amongst EU leaders regarding the harm sanctions are causing. Energy and food prices continue to rise in the EU, placing enormous pressure on citizens. Experts warn things could get worse.
We have seen over the last couple of months that there is disparity, there is disunity. There is already an exception for Hungary in terms of energy supply. And my worry is that as soon as the winter sets in, there might be a problem, and then we have to see how long the support for the sanctions will materialise.
Ordinary citizens are asking why we don't hear more about peace negotiations.
The price you pay now is out of control. Gas, oil, electricity, food. It's all gone crazy. We need to end the war.
As the West continues to pump billions of euro and dollars into Ukraine, the country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is sacking senior officials. Analysts say it shows the country remains corrupt at the highest levels. The European Commission will unveil much-anticipated plans on Wednesday designed to ensure the EU doesn't run out of gas this winter. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The British capital is boiling with July temperatures rarely seen in the country. For some, it's business as usual, a chance to bask in it. For others, a cause for concern.
I would say climate changing.
every year it's just getting hotter and hotter. In other countries like Dubai and Kuwait, that's 50, 60 degrees. That's normal nowadays.
Basically, we let it go like downhill for like 200 years, for example. And now we just, we're doing something wrong here, you know. But at least the realization is a first step. So hopefully they will take it more serious and start actually doing something.
With temperatures climbing up to 41 degrees Celsius over the next 2 days, the National Meteorological Service has issued its first ever red warning for exceptional heat for much of the country.
Britain is a country where people are used to complaining about the wet weather. Now this scorching heat is going to give them something else to gripe about. But it doesn't stop there. There's real concern about how these rising temperatures will impact the everyday life.
Metro passengers have been urged not to travel by train. Schools are only allowing early pickups after the government said they had to stay open and that people should be resilient enough to enjoy the sunshine. Climate activists are threatening more decisive action to perceived inaction by government and big business, similar to the Extinction Rebellion protest that shut down parts of central London a few years ago. The activists' frustration now confirmed by the UK's climate minister, Alok Sharma, who has accused some of the candidates running for prime minister of being lukewarm on achieving the country's net zero target. And this week, his plea for climate action as he addressed the Petersburg Climate Dialogue in Berlin.
I have to say, and I say this with all sincerity, that many of the commitments that we heard in Glasgow remain just that. They are still just words on a page. And you know, because you can see this around you, all the evidence tells us that time is running out.
Climate scientists say the next decade will be defined by greater weather extremes. But the fear is it'll also be shaped by humanity's collective failure to do more. Syed Purizap, London.
Mashhad, a tourist magnet in northeast Iran. Every year, some 30 million pilgrims from across the Muslim world travel to Mashhad to visit the holy shrine of Imam Reza, the 8th Shia Imam. But a few miles away from the shrine, there's a whole new world for tourists who would also like to enjoy natural resorts after a spiritual journey. Welcome to Kuh Sangi, a heaven at the heart of Mashhad, as described by this Iraqi family.
We come from Iraq. We visited the holy shrine of Imam Reza, and then I found about this amazing place called Kuh Sangi and came with my family to enjoy the scenery.
It's my second trip to Mashhad. The city offers you a whole traveling package that includes pilgrimage and recreation.
Kuh Sangi is one of a myriad of attractions in Mashhad. Natural resorts such as Shandi's and Chali Dara Valley, and recreational centers such as Water Waves Land and Iram Amusement Park are among the must-see places in Mashhad. The city is also home to 10,000 historical sites. Only 1,500 of those sites have so far been registered and developed for tourists.
One of the major attractions of Mashhad is its restaurants and street eateries. Mashhad is the city of foods. It has numerous restaurants serving a variety of local and international foods. Mashhad also has more than 680 parks, providing a chance for visitors to entertain themselves besides their pilgrimage.
Mashhad is also a hotspot for health tourism in the region. Only in 2021, over 24,000 health tourists visited the city, mainly from Iraq and Oman, earning the city roughly $48 million. Authorities in Mashhad say the potentials are countless, but so are the challenges. To foreign visitors, Mashhad is still a religious-only city, and many are not aware of its recreational capacities.
We at the municipality are trying to raise awareness of the attractions in Mashhad. One of those efforts is the launching of the English version of our website, which guides foreign travelers through the city online. We will soon launch the Arabic webpage as well.
Due to the large number of visitors throughout the year, Mashhad has one of the best-equipped public transport systems in the country. It has a growing subway network and bus rapid transit system, beside other transportation services, making it easy to access the desired tourist destinations in the city. Known as the spiritual capital of Iran,
Mashhad seems to offer more than a spiritual experience to visitors. With its spectacular natural resorts and growing number of recreational centers, Mashhad municipality plans to turn the city into a tourist hub in the region. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Mashhad.
Yet another wave of COVID-19 is hitting South Korea, with cases doubling to 40,000 per day in the past week. The BA5 Omicron subvariant accounts for almost a third of the new cases, a portion that is increasing. While experts recognize vaccines may not always prevent infection, they decrease illnesses and deaths.
Even people who have been infected with Omicron before are not able to develop enough immunity to this variant unless they are vaccinated. People who have been fully vaccinated and boosted but become infected have reduced chances of severe illness of 70 to 90%.
The fatality rate of COVID-19 has dropped to near the seasonal flu. Still, experts argue that changed behaviors of mask wearing and routine vaccinations should remain in place.
The recent spike in COVID-19 cases here comes as South Korea Thursday detects the first case of BA2.75, nicknamed Centaurus. Scientists worry this highly mutated Omicron variant is even more transmissible than previous strains.
Some want stronger antivirus enforcement, suggesting public apathy risks another COVID-induced economic downturn. People are required to wear masks on transit, but the government has said it will not implement lockdowns. People over 50 will be offered fourth vaccinations next week. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A debate in the European Parliament has heard that 22% of people in the EU are struggling to make ends meet. That's almost 100 million citizens who are counting every cent. Apparently, sending weapons to Ukraine is not the answer.
The best way to deal with the cost of living crisis is to stop prolonging the war. The people of Europe favour peace, even well above punishing Russia.
EU financial markets are in turmoil. There are calls for the introduction of a windfall tax.
Energy prices and food prices are going through the roof. Capitalists make profits by speculating on markets and thereby hurting millions of households.
Members of the public have been talking to us about the current state of the EU's economy.
It's terrifying to see that our free market is like collapsing. All the money that we are going to send to Ukraine, then we will have to need this money, and where we are going to take this money from.
The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has been singled out for criticism in the European Parliament.
We turn now about the increase of cost of living in the European Union, which is just a result of the insane and unsound policies promoted by the European Union since Ursula von der Leyen took office.
There have been calls for greater solidarity between EU member states to deal with the cost of living crisis.
In order to make sure that we are not at the end dividing Europe in those who are able to help and those who have more difficulties.
On sanctions against Russia, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has said, quote, "Initially I thought that we had only shot ourselves in the foot, but now it is clear that the EU economy has shot itself in the lungs and is gasping for air." Many here agree. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Despite the UN brokered truce, the consequences of the Saudi-led war are still taking the lives of Yemeni women and children. A recent report by the International Committee of the Red Cross says a mother and six newborns die every 2 hours in Yemen of complications that occur during pregnancy and causes that can be avoided in normal circumstances.
There is a severe shortage of medical supplies and medicines, as well as a significant increase in the prices of medicines, which has led to the deterioration of health services not only in the countryside, but even in main cities.
We as gynecologists have noticed a significant increase in the number of abortions, especially premature abortions in the early stages of pregnancy. Therefore, we hope to conduct studies that will reveal to us the reason and whether or not the prohibited weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition contributed to this tragedy.
The committee says the numbers are likely to increase due to a lack of health services or poor care provided, especially amid a shortage of funding for the United Nations programs in Yemen, as well as the termination of aid related to reproductive health and mother and child health. Recently, most of the United Nations programs, including the World Food Programme, announced the suspension of their humanitarian activities in Yemen due to a lack of funding, as well as the consequences of the Russia-Ukraine war.
Yemeni health officials say 19 million Yemenis lack access to health care. They say it is a shame for the international community to abandon Yemeni women and the children who have been paying the highest price since the beginning of the Saudi-led war in Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Yet another wave of COVID-19 is hitting South Korea, with cases doubling to 40,000 per day in the past week. The BA5 Omicron subvariant accounts for almost a third of the new cases, a portion that is increasing. While experts recognize vaccines may not always prevent infection, they decrease illnesses and deaths.
Even people who have been infected with Omicron before are not able to develop enough immunity to this variant unless they are vaccinated. People who have been fully vaccinated and boosted but become infected have reduced chances of severe illness of 70 to 90%.
The fatality rate of COVID-19 has dropped to near the seasonal flu. Still, experts argue that changed behaviors of mask wearing and routine vaccinations should remain in place.
The recent spike in COVID-19 cases here comes as South Korea Thursday detects the first case of BA2.75, nicknamed Centaurus. Scientists worry this highly mutated Omicron variant is even more transmissible than previous strains.
Some want stronger antivirus enforcement, suggesting public apathy risks another COVID-induced economic downturn.
I know that more than 90% of corona can be prevented by wearing a mask, but if people keep coming inside and taking off their masks, I feel like it will be impossible to stop the spread. So the government should take stronger measures in that area.
People are required to wear masks on transit, but the government has said it will not implement lockdowns. People over 50 will be offered fourth vaccinations next week. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Every year in the lunar month of Dhul Hijjah, Muslims celebrate Eid al-Ghadir, a major festivity on the Islamic calendar, marking the day when Prophet Muhammad appointed Ali ibn Abi Talib, the first Shia imam, as his successor, and Muslims' next leader some 14 centuries ago. In Iran's city of Mashhad, the shrine of Imam Reza has been hosting pilgrims who have come days ahead of the auspicious occasion to celebrate the festivity.
Happy Eid al-Ghadir to all fellow Muslims. I come from Iraq to participate in the celebrations here in Mashhad.
Eid al-Ghadir marks the day when Prophet Muhammad announced to Muslims that Imam Ali is the next Muslim leader. He raised Imam Ali's hand and said, "Whoever I am their leader, Ali is their leader too." The Prophet was on his way back from his last Hajj pilgrimage, where he was accompanied by many people.
Eid al-Ghadir comes 8 days after another major festivity on the Islamic lunar calendar, dubbed Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice. The occasion marks the climax of the annual Hajj pilgrimage.
To us Iranians, it's a blessing to visit the shrine of Imam Reza on the Feast of Sacrifice and other festivities. Those of us who can't make it to Mecca on the Hajj usually come to Imam Reza's shrine to pray and enjoy the spiritual atmosphere.
Imam Reza is the 8th Shia Imam, whose bloodline goes back to the Prophet of Islam. He holds a special position among Iranians since he spent his last years of life in Iran, away from his birthplace in modern-day Saudi Arabia. Every year, his holy shrine hosts millions of pilgrims from around the Muslim world, especially during religious occasions. Iranians never miss a chance to come and visit the shrine of Imam Reza. And now that Eid al-Ghadir is just around the corner, Shia Muslims find it an opportunity to once again attend this holy site and share the festive mood with each other. Yusuf Jalali from the Holy Shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad.
Everyone is invited to this party
that stretches for 10 kilometers in Tehran. As Shia Muslims around the world are marking Eid al-Ghadir, Iranians have got together in this festival to share the happy mood with each other.
This beautiful celebration has drawn many Iranians to enjoy Eid al-Ghadir festivity together. I congratulate all my fellow Muslims on the Eid.
Happy Eid al-Ghadir to all Muslims. We Shia Muslims regard this festivity as a chance to renew our allegiance with Imam Ali, our first Imam.
Eid al-Ghadir marks the beginning of Shia Islam some 14 centuries ago, when Prophet Muhammad appointed Ali ibn Abi Talib, the first Shia Imam, as his successor and Muslims' next leader.
On Eid al-Ghadir, Prophet Muhammad raised Imam Ali's hand and said, "Whoever am their leader, Ali is their leader too." The Prophet was on his way back from his last Hajj pilgrimage, where he was accompanied by many people.
Imam Ali was the cousin of Prophet Muhammad and is known as the first man to embrace the Prophet's call for Islam. According to Islamic references, Imam Ali rooted out poverty and promoted an unprecedented justice system across the Muslim world during his short rule based in Iraq's city of Kufa.
Imam Ali represents justice, humanity, and chivalry. During his rule, he eliminated sexual and racial discrimination and promoted kindness.
Here, not only do Iranians celebrate Eid al-Ghadir, they get to teach their kids about who Imam Ali was.
I named my son after Imam Ali. It's not just about his name. I like him to act and behave like Imam Ali. That's why I brought him to this ceremony. Imam Ali is a role model for all of us.
In Shia Islam, there are 12 imams or religious leaders, all believed to have preserved the legacy of the Prophet. Mahdi is the last imam, who is believed to be the apocalyptic savior of the world and is currently living in occultation. To Muslims, Eid al-Ghadir is a time when God perfected their religion by introducing Imam Ali as their next leader. That's why they celebrate it every year to honor Imam Ali as the father of Shia Islam, a symbol of Islamic justice. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. All praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master, Muhammad, and upon his immaculate progeny, particularly the remnant of God on earth. I welcome you, dear brothers and sisters. You are influential figures for the important issues of the country. One of the important things that the judiciary does is influencing the most important issues of the country. This is the role you play. God willing, you will be successful. This is a grace from God. I am pleased that thanks to God, this epidemic has become somewhat less now, and we have been blessed with the success of being able to visit you in person. First of all, I wish to honour the memory of the dear martyr, the late Shaheed Ayatollah Beheshti. May God be pleased with him. All the martyrs who were martyred along with him, as well as all the martyrs of the judiciary. May God exalt the degrees of all of them by his grace. Shaheed Beheshti was an outstanding personality. He was truly, in all fairness, an outstanding person. From the time he came from abroad and up to the time of his martyrdom during the years before the victory of the revolution, we were continuously working closely with him. I witnessed that truly he was an outstanding personality.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I witnessed the same thing in the organizations where we worked together. The late Ayatollah Taleghani was elected as the chairman of the Revolutionary Council. But this same council unanimously were of the opinion that he needed a vice chairman, and Agha Beheshti was chosen by them to be that vice chairman. Agha Beheshti was in charge of the administration of the Revolutionary Council even during the lifetime of the late Agha Taleghani. He was an outstanding personality. May God exalt his rank by his grace. I would like to take a quick look at the situation during that time in this gathering. These events are something for us to learn from. Taking into consideration the situation that existed 41 years ago on June the 28th can be enlightening. First of all, in those days, the imposed war had created the worst, most difficult situation.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Spotlight.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to special coverage on the Astana peace process over Syria. It was a big day here in Tehran, a pretty busy schedule for the Iranian government, also administration of President Raisi. They were hosting Turkish and, in order respectively, as they arrived, Turkish President, and also we had President Putin of Russia arriving here in the Iranian capital city, Tehran, for talks within the context of the what is called as the Astana peace process. The Astana peace process was initiated in 2017 in Kazakhstan, and we had three guarantors there, Turkey, Russia, Iran, and the aim is to come up with a solution to the Syria crisis. Now, in the last round of talks, discussions were held regarding the Syrian Constitutional Committee, refugee issue, humanitarian crisis, Turkish security concerns, U.S. forces presence, and the remaining pockets of terrorists. So those were the issues that discussed in previous rounds of negotiations, and also in this round of negotiations, the three presidents of Iran, Russia, and Turkey had their addresses, and they started that meeting, and they all emphasized respect for national sovereignty, territorial integrity of Syria. And President Raisi of Iran also highlighted the fact that extra-regional forces like the U.S. forces must leave the region and Syria. They are plundering Syrian oil. And we also have President Putin hoping that the three guarantors of the Astana peace process are trying their best, and they're trying to end international terrorism, including the one wreaking havoc in Syria, that they try to stabilize the situation there. They need to revive Syria's infrastructure and restore security there. Turkish president also said that Syria should be purged from all kinds of terrorists, and hopefully a political solution could be found. Now, to discuss this a little bit, I'm inviting a couple of guests. We'll have Mark Sloboda, international affairs and security analyst, who's joining me from Moscow, and also Elijah Magnier, journalist, simply analyst in Marseille, France. Good to see you both, gentlemen. Let's start with Mark in Moscow. Well, I just gave you a gist of what's happening here in Tehran as we speak. The three leaders are discussing Syria. Let's begin with how significant this Astana peace process is. As President Putin of Turkey just claimed, that this is the only process that seriously is trying to deal with the issues besetting Syria.
Yeah, I would define the Astana peace process in a little more realist terms. I would define it as Russia and Iran managing their proxy war in Syria with Turkey, because that has been the state of affairs since Russia's intervention in 2015, and for Iran, even longer than that. They are on opposing sides in this conflict. And the Erdogan regime, it continues to occupy large swaths of northern Syria and is ethnically cleansing the territory and continues to support al-Qaeda, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, by whatever support it is now. Russia and Iran have managed to weed out all of the other Gulf players through this management of the process with Turkey. Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the United Emirates, they all dropped out of the game, as it were. And right now, it is essentially a Mexican standoff that has been the status quo in the country for years now, with very little changes. And that is the Syrian government, supported by Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah, the Turkish regime with its use of al-Qaeda, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, and other Islamists and jihadists as proxies, and the United States militarily occupying East Syria through its use of the Syrian YPG as their proxy forces. And that standoff continues to this day. And right now, this latest rounds of negotiations were simply Russia and Iran warding Erdogan not to launch another incursion to siege more territory in northern Syria.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Elijah, we had President Raisi of Iran saying that the fate of Syria must be determined by the Syrian people themselves and also Syria-Syria negotiations. The Astana Peace Press also trying to do the same. They bring together representatives from the opposition and also the Syrian central government. Let's speak a little about that.
Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I agree that the main talk was about Syria. However, there are many other important talks during this three president summit in Tehran. But if that you want to talk about Syria, I think the problem there is Russia cannot stand against Turkey on its own because of the war in Ukraine, because Russia needs allies, and Turkey is not an enemy at the time being. And Russia would do very well with the support of Iran because they both have the same objective to stop President Erdogan from taking a security zone, as he calls it, of 30 kilometers and occupying further land than Idlib and the northwest Syria. This is something that the Russian, the Iranian, and the Damascus agree, and because Erdogan imposed himself as a very important player in Syria, they need to talk with him about it, at least to block him. I am not very optimistic about what's going to happen, because as long as President Erdogan is in power, at least for mid-next year, he's not going to give up on Idlib. But I think what the Russian and the Iranians are trying to do is to make sure that he's not going to push his forces in the north east Syria, which are also the Americans present there occupying their part of the country, and they also disagree with President Erdogan's plans because they are the one who are protecting the YPG and the Syrian version of the PKK. So in that regard, I think the Iranian, what they are trying to do in this summit, and they have succeeded in a way, is to make sure that President Erdogan looks at the economic benefit that he's getting from his alliance with Iran and with Russia, particularly that is related to the oil and gas, where both countries that are oil and gas producers are going to give Turkey the energy that he needs, and perhaps he will be the channel that will pass it on to the Europeans. And then President Erdogan will weigh the benefit and the damages that he can create in this alliance with Russia and Iran if he moves forward into the Syrian territory. However, we heard the Iranians and we heard the Russians saying that the integrity of Syria is very important and that they are willing to work all together, including President Bashar al-Assad, to work then against the terrorists, whoever they are, because they were not very defined in this conversation, in this summit, for a particular reason, because it is not meant to go into small details. That's why reviving Astana and introducing the fact that it's important to go to a new constitution, all these elements, I think people remain on their position, but the aim now is to calm down the game in Syria.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Mark, let's now take a look at the stabilizing or destabilizing roles that international players, what they are doing in this region. The U.S. president the other day was talking about what he called Iran's destabilizing role in this region, but I wonder what he's talking about. I mean, if you remember, Iran, General Soleimani helped Iraqis on the request of the Iraqi government to help the nation and government to get rid of Daesh, and he made a great contribution, as you know. Iran is holding this Astana peace process in order to try to bring peace and tranquility back to Syria, getting the opposition representatives and the government to sit at the table and try to address their issues. Iran also offered the Hormuz Peace Initiative during the previous administration, in which it offered Persian Gulf littoral states to again get around the negotiating table and discuss any issues and any points of concerns that they have. So what now, let's compare and to see what actions the U.S. has taken in this region and what Iran is doing. Who's playing a destabilizing role?
Yeah, I mean, of course, who is destabilizing is in the eye of the beholder. The U.S. imagines itself as the hegemonic power in the Middle East, you know, from the other side of the world. And it manages its hegemony in the Middle East through a tripod relationship with Saudi Arabia and Israel, and is constantly working to improve the ties between the two of them, so it is at least something more than a hub-and-spoke type relationship. And when the U.S. government talks about Iran's stabilizing interests, they mean that it is undermining its hegemony of the region, of the region, and in particular, they're referring to Iran's long principled support of Palestine and their opposition to the Israeli military occupation and slow ethnic cleansing of Palestine, as well, of course, as their own local geopolitical rival with the Saudi dictatorship. So that is what is meant by the term destabilizing, even though the U.S. of course tries to paint themselves as the good guys and Iran as the bad guys in simplistic Manichaean terms.
Okay, yeah, but Elijah, when you look at what the U.S. has done in this part of the world, the first question is, as Iran is always insisting, that regional states can resolve their regional problems on their own. They don't need any extra-regional power. And given what the U.S. has done in Iraq, in Afghanistan, its proxy war in Yemen, helping the Saudis, and you name it, you know, China and others and Russia, actually the Ukraine thing. So how could you, I mean, this, you cannot square this off with what they're talking about. In the first place, what's the U.S. doing in this part of the world? And is it trying to stabilize this region or destabilize it and set this country off against the other country in order to sell you know, as arms and weaponry and make big bucks?
Well, since 1991, I remember when I was covering the war in Kuwait, the Americans destroyed the infrastructure in Kuwait while Saddam Hussein was withdrawing, and with the aim to rebuild Kuwait and make space for the American companies. In whatever the Americans are doing, starting from demonizing Iran, is to make sure they sell weapons to the Gulf countries, make sure that they separate Iran from the Gulf country, create a havoc in the region, because divide and rule, that is the principle of the Americans, who have no morale in human rights or politics or in their objectives, not only in the Middle East, but also in other parts, in Asia and in Latin America and in Africa, everywhere. What they have done in Iraq is the best example. What they have done in Syria, the President Donald Trump had no shame in saying, I want the oil. We had four-star U.S. generals who were saying, have we become pirate? So this is what the Americans is about. By imposing sanctions on Syria, imposing the Caesar Act, preventing Jordan from opening the border for many years, occupying Al-Tanf, the border between Iraq and Syria, is to cripple the Syrian economy, preventing the Gulf country to return to Syria to invest in the reconstruction, is to really break the back of the population. Imposing sanctions on Iran since 1979 under President Jimmy Carter until President Biden today, who continue increasing the sanction, is again to turn the population against their ruler. All these objectives in Lebanon, in Palestine, they are very strong and powerful example of what the U.S. Has been doing in the region to make sure that the region is weak. It's a burned territory. However, we see that this is not going to last forever. because we start seeing very clear indication from countries in the region to meet together, meeting in different parts. Now the Americans are out of the negotiation between Saudis and the Iranians, and the Iranians and the Egyptians and the Jordanians. All that is happening in an Arab Islamic country that is in Iraq. That these are very good signs and strong messages sent to the Americans that we can solve our problem without you, and you better stay away. And that was again reconfirmed during the last meeting and the summit of President Biden in Jeddah, where the language of the Saudis and the Gulf country was positive. It was not demonizing Iran as usual. It was saying extending peace to Iran and saying exactly what the Iranians have been saying. We want to talk together, we want peace, we want to sort out our differences. Now I think the world is shifting.
Now, Mark, another topic that was highlighted in this Astana negotiations, especially just a few hours ago, is trying to fight terrorism, and especially terrorism in the region and also including Syria that's located in this region. So, is this, when you look at it from another perspective, that's how the previous U.S. administration, maybe this one also, was looking. They tried to divide the terrorists into different groups, the good ones and bad ones, and then they, once they supported this group of terrorists, the other day they say these are not good terrorists, and they change the location. So what is it that they are planning to do? I mean, what's the right way, what's the right course to actually fight and purge terrorism from this region?
Yeah, I mean, the same problem is highlighted in the limitations of the Astana.
Well, we just lost that connection. Elijah, go ahead if you heard my question with the answer.
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
In a nutshell, I was asking the right path to fight international terrorism in this region.
Well, international terrorism was the main job, for example, in Syria, of the Syrian government and the Syrian army. They are the one who fought terrorism in Syria in collaboration and the support of their allies. Haji Shabi is the one who fought terrorism in Iraq, and not the Americans. They are the one with the Iranian and other allies who stood against the extension of Daesh power that the Americans watched during Barack Obama without moving. And all this terrorism that has been supported by the Americans in the region is to create a sectarian war among Muslims in the Islamic world, to find another way to cripple the economy of the Middle East, to make it engage internally against one another. All that is now over because the population in the countries like in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen stood against the terrorists, and they fought against the terrorists, and this is a card that is no longer valid today. Now, if you look at the region in Syria, in the north, west, and east of Syria, we see the Americans in good terms with Abu Muhammad al-Julani, who is the ex-emir of Daesh and ex-emir of Al-Qaeda. And we see on the other side, in the east, they are the ones who are protecting what President Erdogan is saying, the Kurdish terrorists that are the PKK branch, the Syrian branch. So we always see the hand of the Americans in every single support to terrorists in the Middle East, West Asia.
Okay, looks like we have a connection with Mark. Mark, sorry about that technical hitch. Go ahead with your comments.
Yeah, I what we see with the problem with the limitations of the Astana process is the same problems that you see at the United Nations when discussing the topic of terrorism. The problems with defining it and the problems with deciding who the terrorists are, because everyone thinks they're someone different. And the Astana process has achieved a lot, but it's really reached its limitations. Because when Russia and Iran and the Syrian government are talking about terrorists, they're principally talking about Al-Qaeda, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, and the 31 flavors of jihad that have long been the proxies of Turkey and previously the United States and the Gulf Cooperation Council countries in Syria. Meanwhile, when Turkey is talking about terrorists, it's not talking about Al-Qaeda. It does not view them as terrorists. I mean, officially they do, but in reality, they are, of course, arming, funding, and supporting them, cooperating with them. They have for years. They're talking about the YPG and the PKK, and right. It has to be said that Russia does not recognize those groups as terrorists. So in order to avoid a complete breakdown of the Astana process, which the three countries still find useful to a degree for managing their proxy war in Syria, it has kept the conflict effectively frozen for a time. They refer to terrorism without defining who the terrorists are. Turkey's talking about the YPG, the PKK, and Russia, Iran, and Syria, whom they represent, are talking about Turkey's proxies.
Okay. And Elijah, President Putin said that the U.S. agenda for Syria is to plunder its resources. That's happening, and we hear reports just a few days ago, and also disintegrating Syria. Do you share the same view?
I do, actually, because the 23% to 25% of the Syrian territory that is under the U.S. occupation is the basket of food for the Syrian population and the basket of energy, the source of energy for Syria. And now today, Syria is relying on the support of Iran and Russia to receive the wheat and the food and the oil that is needed, because the Americans not only have imposed sanctions on Syria that are very harsh and very powerful, but they are stealing the oil and transporting it from Syria to Iraq, and then they are selling it, and they are using it, they're giving it to Turkey, and they exchange it to oil that they take back home. So all that, and preventing the Syrians from recovering their territory, which the Syrian army is very capable of to do today, it's also a way for the Americans that they have no policy, no strategy in Syria today under Joe Biden, is to keep their forces in Syria and to make sure that they cripple the Syrian economy. Now, we also see that their position in Iraq is also complementary to their position in Syria, because the Iraqis will kick them out sooner or later. So they consider that their presence in their area, where they offer support also to the Israelis who are bombing Syria on a regular basis, and the Israelis are using the military air bases and airports that are under the U.S. occupation in the northeast Syria. All these elements represent the policy of the U.S. to really break the Syrian country and the Syrian population, and to make sure they don't recover very quickly.
Okay, that's all the time we have for